brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia.
Ivan Sutherland is widely seen as one of the founders of virtual reality and computer graphics. In this 1996 lecture, Virtual Reality Before It Had That Name, Sutherland goes over his early work at Harvard.
From Bob Sproul than I've learned from anybody else. Bob is quite amazing. He showed up when I was first teaching at Harvard. He was an undergraduate there. And he had graduated from Phillips Exeter Academy and gone to Harvard on a Westinghouse full tuition scholarship, having won the Westinghouse Science Talent Search. And he was clearly one of the brightest students that had ever walked across my threshold. And we started then what's turned out to be a lifetime association, for which I'm very thankful. And as I said before, Bob will be showing up shortly. He's going to give his part of this talk. We have kind of a repartee. I'm going to tell you how I thought it was, and he's going to tell you how it really was. Things happened in our computer room at Harvard late at night when the faculty wasn't there. And that's his part of the talk. My part of the talk is sort of the straight stuff, right? When you have a talk like this, you always have to acknowledge everybody in sight and thank them all for all the things they did. So I sat down with Bob and we sort of thought about who was it who contributed to this activity. Harvard supported me. Harvard University has a very interesting rule. They do not allow their faculty to take support on contracts at all. Harvard has a very large endowment and it believes that the permanent faculty should be paid for out of endowment funds and not out of contract funds, which is a very wise maneuver because it says should contract money dry up, they are still able to continue paying their permanent faculty. Interesting place, Harvard. I'll tell you some more stories about them in a minute. Westinghouse, of course, supported Bob on a full tuition scholarship. And Bell Helicopter featured importantly in the early head-mounted display work. They had done some work in using head-mounted displays for helicopter pilots. I found out about that, and they were extremely helpful. I visited them in Fort Worth on a couple of occasions, and they provided some equipment and considerable help to us, so thanks to Bell Helicopter. Bell Laboratories gave a grant to Harvard of a few thousand dollars every year, and we used that money for a couple of years. It actually purchased the piece of equipment which Gwen Bell now has in the Computer Museum, and you'll see a picture of it a little later. Now here's the most interesting one. I had been working in Washington for a couple of years beforehand and made some friends at the CIA. And you may recall that in the early 60s, the CIA got in considerable trouble because they had sponsored the Students for a Democratic Society and created some turmoil inside the borders of the United States, which they are not supposed to do. So they were looking for a very upstanding, very sensible place that they could put some research money in a totally unclassified, totally above board way to kind of make up for the malfeasance that they'd been involved in a little while before. And, you know, being a reasonable fellow, I said, hey, money's money, let's take it. So I sent them a proposal, and they said yes in about a week and a half, and sent a check, you know, it was $80,000, as I remember. And we got to work on the project. Well, it wasn't too long after that before the students found out about this, and the old mole was the liberal rag in Boston at the time, and there was a splash in the old mole about Harvard taking this filthy CIA money. There was a big controversy about it. And so Dean Ford, who was the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the time, he organized a debate in the faculty, and he had 8 speakers. They got 15 minutes each, and he went against the taking of this money, for taking the money, against, for, against. And he saved the last slot for himself, and he was clearly for it. Well, now it speaks either to my naivete as a young associate professor then, or the eloquence of the Harvard faculty, that I changed my opinion on whether I should have taken this money 8 times. And Dean Ford won the day with the following argument. He said, the source of funds makes not the slightest difference whatsoever. The only thing that matters is the conditions of the grant. If you find $1,000 sitting on your doorstep with no strings attached, take it and enjoy it. Doesn't matter where it came from. It says Harvard above all should recognize this, since most of Harvard's endowment came from the triangle trade. Okay, the United States Air Force provided our PDV-1 computer, and MIT Lincoln Laboratory did some stuff on our acoustic head position sensor. This is the group that was involved, Bob and myself, and these people were kind of the core group. And I think it's evidence of the fact that graduate school is a place where people form long-time ties. Chuck Seitz was a graduate student who was working on the project with us, and Dan Cohen was also. They're now in business in Southern California, have been friends ever since that time. I'll show you a picture of Steve Koons later on. Steve Koons was an important part of our project and a very wonderful gentleman. Little history before we showed up at Harvard. I had done a PhD at MIT with a thesis called Sketchpad, which was the subject of an earlier lecture in this series. Then I went to the National Security Agency for a while, and then I was transferred to the Pentagon as a first lieutenant in the United States Army. It was rather a strange position because my boss was a civilian. He happened to be Bob Sproul's father, as a matter of fact, but I didn't know the Bob Sproul that'll be here this afternoon then. I only knew Bob Sproul Sr., his father, who was my boss. And when I went to work there, Bob Sproul Sr. and the Army had an argument over the press release. And the Army thought that they should announce that Lieutenant Sutherland went and took this post in Washington, and Bob Sproul thought that it should be Dr. Sutherland. And apparently this press release went back and forth half a dozen times and never did get released. And the problem, of course, was that there were 7 offices in ARPA at that time. And 2 of them were run by military people, and the other 5 by civilians. Civilians were no problem. But the other military fellow who ran one of the offices was Major General Winnicky. And so General Winnicky and I used to go to staff meetings, and we used to sit beside each other. He always wore his uniform. I never wore mine. And he always called me Ivan, and I always called him Sir. And we got along just fine. I don't think he knew I was in the service at all. And boy, I sure wasn't going to tell him. So anyhow, I got out of the service, stayed on as a civilian for a while, and then went to Harvard in 1966. And Bob, of course, had graduated from Phillips Exeter Academy, had been at Harvard a little longer than I had, and I met him in 1966 when I got there. Now, the idea for the head-mounted display, which is what we called it at that time, came through some work that the Bell Helicopter Company had done for night vision helicopter pilots. The problem was a helicopter pilot wants to land in the clearing at night, and he has to somehow keep clear of the trees around the edge of the field. And so they thought, we'll give him an infrared camera to look through so that he can see all of these trees and stuff and land quite successfully. And in those days, the infrared camera equipment was quite large and bulky. And so their plan was to mount it on the bottom of the helicopter and then slave the position of the camera to the position of the pilot's head and mount some goggles on the pilot's head that would transmit a cathode ray tube image of whatever the infrared camera saw to the pilot, so he would then see what the camera saw. And I heard about this, and I heard about 2 key experiments that they did. And the 2 key experiments were kind of interesting. They mounted just a regular video camera on the roof of their building. And they put a person with the goggles on somewhere inside the building. And then they had 2 people on the roof playing catch. And they were playing catch with a tennis ball. And this fellow would watch the tennis ball go back and forth, turning his head to keep the tennis ball in view of the video camera. And he was quite comfortable with the notion that he was able to watch this game of catch. And then one of the players threw the ball at the camera. And the guy inside the building ducked. Okay, which was pretty clear evidence that he had identified his position as being at the location of the camera rather than safely ensconced in the room that he was in. And then they did one other thing to him. They said, well, why don't you look down? Which he did. And unbeknownst to him, they had actually mounted the camera about 3 feet out on a board over the edge of the 4-story building. So when he looked down, there was nothing underneath. And apparently he got quite a substantial shock. again evidence that he identified his location as that of the camera rather than the location of himself. And I had heard about these two experiments and made the leap of faith that said, why do we have to have a real image from a real camera? Why can't we simply compute an image and display a computed image, changing the computed image in the same way that the video camera changes the real image, and thereby immerse an individual in a synthetic environment? And so I went to Harvard with the notion that this was a project that we could use to work on. It was a project that was difficult, but not impossible. It was certainly easy to understand what the objective was. The objective was to let an observer immerse himself inside a computed image. And the important thing was that we could measure head position. We did not have to measure eye position. Measuring eye position is very difficult. Measuring head position is pretty easy. You can fasten some kind of helmet on the head and measure that position. It's harder to fasten things to your eyeballs. So what did we need to complete this project? We needed basically four things. We needed a head position sensor of some kind so the computer could know which direction the guy's head was facing, whether it was up, down, sideways, or tilted. And we needed some kind of a database. Well, as you'll see, we didn't need very much of that because the equipment was pretty crude in those days. We kind of put that one off. We needed some display generation equipment to produce the three-dimensional perspective images quickly enough so that the observer would get the impression that those images were around him. And we needed some kind of a CRT display device to display the images on. Well, the first display device that we had came from Bell Helicopter. It was a single-eye device which had a little reflecting mirror and a small CRT, and it was rather crude, had a very narrow field of view, and we fairly soon abandoned that for a thing that we purchased from PerkinElmer Company, which was this head-mounted display device. It has two CRTs mounted in these cylinders at the back with the wires coming out in the back. And then there's a lens arrangement, and the thing in front of the user's eyes is a half-silvered mirror embedded in a prism. So he sees superimposed on the world around him, he sees the cathode ray tube images. It provided images to both eyes. It was nicely adjustable. And as you can see, it spread out quite a bit behind him because it was intended originally for use with a pilot with an APH-5 helmet on, and the CRTs were intended to clear the helmet. And we simply purchased the third one of these. Bell Helicopter had purchased two of them from PerkinElmer and paid for the initial development cost. And we bought another one from PerkinElmer at the incremental cost of buying another piece. So the overall system block diagram that we ended up with looks like this. And what you can see is we have some kind of a head position measuring device which feeds head positions to a computer that then figures out what to say to a matrix multiplier that does the rotation transformation. And that passes information to some kind of a clipping device which does the perspective transformation. I'll say quite a bit more about that in a little while. And that passes information to some kind of an analog display driver, which then displays the information on the CRT. And I said earlier that we put off the database problem for a while. I'll show you the most complicated image we ever saw through this device. Now, if you look carefully at this image, you'll find that the letters N, S, W, and E are not in the planes of the four sides of the cube. As I remember, this cube is in fact 6 inches in size, and the letters are staggered in a half an inch. And so one of the things that we would ask an observer to do is line yourself up with the edges of one of these cubes and look at the letter edge on and tell us how far inside the cube it is. And sure enough, observers could easily enough move their head to the right position to get an edge on view of one of the edges of the cube and observe that the letter was slightly inside. Here you can see a little more clearly that the W is inside the edge of the cube. Well, so that was the equipment we needed. And we had a computer. By some magic, which I never quite understood, Harvey Brooks, who was the dean at that time, managed to talk the Air Force out of this PDP-1 computer. And it was an enormous PDB-1 computer. It may have been the biggest PDB-1 ever bought. I don't know. It had been in some Air Force laboratory, not being used very much when Harvey Brooks talked them out of it. It came to Harvard after I'd been there 6 months or so. We put it in the basement of Kraft Laboratory. It was right on the same level as the ground, and when it rained, we used to have to sweep the water out to try and keep the computer from drowning. It had 24,000 words of 18-bit memory for a total of about 48 kilobytes. Put this thing in context, it was 5 microsecond memory, which gives it about 0.1 MIPS of computing power. It had fanfold paper tape, and at one point a sign appeared which said, "If there are computers in hell, they will use paper tape." Paper tape is not a pleasant medium for any of you who have to use it. It produces chad, for one thing, and it's slow, and glad it's gone. So then it had some deck tape and some other things on it. It had 3 displays. I guess I've got a picture of those that I'll show in just a minute. We had people. The most exciting thing about Harvard was there was this wonderful collection of people. And there were people from all around who came to make use of the PDB-1. And here's a list that Bob and I sat down and produced just from memory to remember kind of people who had been there. I'll mention a few of these. J.C.R. Licklider made use of our machine. He's the man who coined the phrase man-machine symbiosis, was one of the very early time-sharing people, and an absolutely wonderful man. He did a great many wonderful things for a great many people. William Newman came as a postdoc to Harvard and worked in our group, and he and Bob subsequently wrote the computer graphics text, which I know as Newman and Sproul. It actually has a title, but who knows the title and who cares, right? Let's see who else was there. Todd Wipke was a chemist who came to make use of the PDB-1 to look at chemical molecules, one of the very early visualization of chemistry activities that went on. D.D. Pei was an interesting case. I gave this computer graphics course, and I insisted that each of the students come in and talk to me beforehand to make sure they had enough prerequisites and so on. And this guy came in, D.D. Pei, and he said, he's a physics major, he wanted to take my computer graphics course, and I said, "Well, why are you interested in computer graphics?" He says, "Well, I want to do a little architecture," and I said, "Well, how come you're interested in architecture?" And he says, "Well," he says, "my father's an architect." Some other people you might know, Ben Wegbright is here in the area. He was one of the founders of Stardent Computer, is now, I think, working for Hambrick and Quist, although he may have gone on to the next thing beyond that. So anyhow, these are a few of the people that were around at that time and that we had a wonderful time with. I think at this point I'm going to turn this guy out and raise the screen. I have a few pictures of some of these people. This is the late Steve Koons. Steve Koons was one of my thesis committee and was a mechanical engineer who was the person who introduced us to projective geometry and the use of homogeneous coordinates. And it was Steve whose continuous sort of emphasis on good mathematics, I think, led to the view of the matrix multiplication as a way of compounding rotations to make the whole job understandable and easy. Let's see who else is on this collection of things here. This is the back of Chuck Seitz's head. And this is the equipment that we built. We'll be talking about that a little later. There were 3 racks, as I recall, of equipment to do the computations that we needed to do. Here's a picture of 2 of the scopes on the PDP-1. There were 3 scopes like this. This is Ted Lee, who was my teaching assistant. And you see here a curve. We began to experiment with the use of homogeneous coordinates to produce various curves that you can produce from basic conic sections. And there was some quite interesting work done on the issue of representing curves at that time. Here's Harry Lewis. Harry Lewis was a classmate of Bob's, was a junior when I first met him and a senior. I remember reading Harry Lewis's thesis, senior thesis at Harvard, and on the last page, I found the abstract. He had put an abstract on which said something of the effect, if you read this thesis, you will find out something or other. I forget exactly what it was. And on the last page, he told you what the answer was. And I take the position that the abstract of any document is there to let you avoid reading it if you wish. And so the answer ought to be in the abstract. So Harry had to move his answer into the front of his thesis before I'd let it go through. Harry is now the dean of Harvard College. Now, we had kind of an interesting scheme for allocating PDB-1 time. PDB-1 was a precious resource, and like all computers, it didn't wear out if you used it. In fact, it was rather better to leave it running. And there were a lot of people who wanted to use it, and the problem was, how do we allocate time on it? And so we used a scheme that I called the Yen system. It was a continuous auction. And the idea was that you had a certain number of yen, which were reservation tokens for future computer time. And there was a scheduling board, of which this is a picture, on which you could reserve time in the future. And so, for example, here's each day is represented here. And you can see some places where there's been some bidding done. And then some of these days have a line, a black line drawn over them, which was the indication that the bidding is frozen. 8 o'clock every morning when my secretary came in, she would go down to the computer room and freeze the time for the next day. But up until the schedule was frozen, you could outbid anybody who had bid for time. So if you wanted time from 2 to 4 and somebody had put 3 yen on the time from 2 to 4, which is a yen and a half an hour, and you had 4 yen of reservation tokens, you could say, I'll have that time, please, and I'll bid 4 yen for it. And so the price of computer time in yen was controlled by whatever the market wanted it to be. And that turned out to work very well. At undesirable hours, like 9 o'clock in the morning, computer time was very cheap. At desirable hours, like 1 a.m., computer time might be quite expensive. And the price of computer time just at the end of the term went up quite a bit. And the price, you know, during holidays and so on. There was always the problem of the hour between 2 and 3 a.m. in the spring. Okay, there is an hour between 2 and 3 a.m. in the spring which doesn't exist. Okay, and it routinely got signed up for by God. Let's see what else I can tell you. Yen were not spendable. They were reservation tokens. So when you used the time, you got them back. And that was the important feature of this auction, which is you didn't have so many yen per month. You had so many yen, period. And that meant that the amount of future time that you could have reserved on the schedule was controlled by your purchasing power rather than the total amount of time that you used. Now, the result of that was that this PDP-1 was used round the clock 7 days a week. And at undesirable times, the price got very cheap, and a person with 1 yen could come in when nobody else wanted the machine and just use it. The Air Force insisted that I report utilization. So every week I sent them a report saying, another week of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. After I'd done this 4 or 5 weeks, I got a call from Major so-and-so who said, now, Dr. Sutherland, he says, it's not necessary to falsify these records. He said, we used this machine for years and years, and it was, you know, ran one shift, and that'd be perfectly satisfactory. We're happy with that. And I said, I'm not falsifying the records. That's what we're getting out of it. So here's a little closer view of that scheduling board. You can see here the freezing of the schedule, and you can see different people's initials with arrows and how they've, you know, James, no overbidding, Pat. Dr. Gagliardi. Gagliardi had a demo or something going on, and so you could put notes on the board. And people were pretty good about cooperating, especially with the faculty.
From the Archives is gathered from the audio holdings of the Computer History Museum. It is produced by curator Chris Garcia. Music is by John Plute. For more information on this lecture and other audio holdings, please visit computerhistory.org. Thanks for listening to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum.
This program- program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.